Well, Terrence O'Malley is out with one more documentary. This one is Tom and Harry, The Boss and the President. Of course, this one is about Tom Pendergast and President Truman. It covers a wide-open era of Kansas City back in the 1920s and 30s. Truman's ties to the Pendergast and the Pendergast machine were long and deep. And here's the amazing thing about Harry Truman. He never apologized for his association with Tom Pendergast. In fact, he stood defiantly with Tom Pendergast. Terrence O'Malley also directed Nellie Don, A Stitch in Time, and Black Hand Straw Man, The History of Organized Crime in Kansas City. Both were box office hits when they were released, and Terrence O'Malley joins us now. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. How are you?
Well, this is an amazing thing to me, Terrence. You know, Harry Truman rose in American politics from Jackson County judge all the way to the presidency. He wouldn't have gotten where he was without the help of the Pendergast machine, and yet he never shied away from standing at the side of a boss politician, even when he had every reason to do just that. Why was that, in your view?
Well, the reason why historically is because Truman's integrity remained intact. What happened was that as the Pendergasts promulgated Truman's political career, Harry was put into more and more positions of power. And as he ascended to that power, Tom Pendergast started to put pressure on him to accede to the way that the Pendergast machine does things, specifically letting contracts to favored contractors so that and Tom would frequently own a piece of all of those contracting companies so that they would receive the business from the Jackson County Administrative Court.
In fact, at one point, Tom Pendergast calls Harry over to the office over on what is
1908 Main Street.
Main Street, and so they all sit down with the contractors who are complaining endlessly that Harry's not helping them out.
He's not playing by the rules of the machine.
Not playing by the rules of the machine.
Right.
Yeah.
And Tom tries to intimidate him a little bit, actually excoriates Harry for his ethical integrity, saying that it's worthless in the real world.
Yeah.
But Harry and Tom says, these boys tell me that you're not going to give them the contracts. And Harry says, well, they can have the contracts if they provide the best services at the most efficient costs. And then Tom looks at the other contractors and says, didn't I tell you, boys, he's the contrariest cuss in Missouri.
Yeah.
And then they went out of the room. And from that point on, Tom Pendergast basically left Harry Truman alone to run that administrative court as Truman saw fit, because he only needed one thing from Truman, really, when it came to that court.
Mm-hmm.
And that was patronage. He needed jobs. And that's where Harry Truman really came through for the machine. If a Republican or a Democrat was to apply for a job, it went to the Democrat. And Harry Truman, throughout his career, never had any issue with that type of patronage.
But you really had a sense from watching your film, Terrence, that that was a moment where Tom Pendergast could have gone a different direction.
Oh, absolutely. He could have made life miserable for Harry Truman. He also had two other votes on the three-judge panel.
That's right.
That Harry was at that moment presiding judge over. And so, yes, he could have made life extremely difficult for Harry Truman. But Tom Pendergast was, in essence, a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And a corrupt businessman, as it later turned out. But nevertheless, he had a facility for understanding how best to get things done. And frankly, if these contractors didn't get this particular job, it was didn't really matter that much to Tom, because he knew that there would be other things coming down the pike, and that Harry would continue to employ people that he sent over to him, which he did a lot.
Yeah,
he had those color-coded pieces of paper that he used to indicate whether a person should be a candidate for a job.
Explain that. That's a terrific detail in your film.
Well, people used to line up outside 1908 Main Street a block and a half long, and they would wait to see Tom, and he had this method that he would use to see people. They came in, stated their business.
And it was very quick. He didn't linger and small talk with folks, you point out. It was come in the door and state your business and let's move on. And he sort of sat, you said he sat on the edge of his chair a little bit, which gave the person, the visitor, sort of the sense that this conversation wasn't going to last real long because Tom looked like he had a place to go to.
Absolutely. And he always wore his hat, too.
Yeah, yeah.
It looked like he was, hurry up, I got things to do, so quick, state what your needs are. And so he had a color-coded system where if someone, if you wrote in red, then that meant to give the give that individual applying for a job right away. If it was in blue, then it meant, well, we're still doing a background check on this fellow. And if it was in black, that meant don't hire this person. He's not part of the machine.
I sort of wondered if the people coming up to Pendergast's office, if word circulated after a while that that was the coded system, and if someone, you'd leave the office and walk away and your buddies would say, well, did you get a blue or a red or whatever the thing was?
Well, it's hard to keep those types of things secret.
Yeah.
And certainly they came out historically after the fact. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all if you know, people were savvy to that.
You know, the legacy of Tom Pendergast, you know, is really what this film is about in some ways. And I was telling my sons about him last night, and one of them asked, so, you know, was Tom Pendergast a good man or not? And I guess to me, in some ways, that's a fairly complicated question.
I would say in many ways, it's a very complicated question.
Yeah.
Tom Pendergast came up under the tutelage of his older brother, Big Jim Pendergast.
Big Jim, yeah.
And Big Jim Pendergast really is recognized as holding, you know, a lot of great political scruples. He never cheated to win an election. But when Tom took control, it was all-out war every election.
And he began to cheat right away.
He did. He did. He started buying votes. They had a big issue with the Metropolitan Streetcar Company.
Yeah.
And that was on the ballot. And literally, Tom was handing money to people to vote in favor of the proposition. And that's called boodle money when you get it like that, because then the streetcar railway company would pay Tom for what he paid out to individuals to vote, you know, in a particular manner. Mm-hmm. And of course it passed. But that was kind of the start of things about 1912, 1914,
right.
When Tom started to ascend to power. Now, he wasn't—
I think Jim had died a couple of years before.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole start of the Pendergast machine, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but the whole start of the Pendergast machine is exemplified in the film by one particular photograph that's never been published before, and that is when Big Jim Pendergast came to Kansas City from St. Joseph in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
He wagered on a horse, a racehorse called Climax, and that horse won, and Big Jim took the earnings from that race and bought a saloon on St. Louis Avenue in the West Bottoms that he called Climax.
And that picture of the tavern had never been seen before?
Never been seen before. And I know that because it's been in the Pendergast family since time immemorial. I mean, since it, and the picture of it, I would say, is from approximately, oh, I'm going to say 1890 or thereabouts. But it's fascinating because Big Jim is in the doorway and two other gentlemen, one of whom very much looks like Tom Pendergast, and then brother John Pendergast, who was a bartender.
I was really struck because you talked to one of, if I have this right, Mike Pendergast's grandsons.
Yes.
And I was struck by, are there Pendergasts walking among us these days? Clearly there are, because you interviewed them for the film, right?
Absolutely. There's
I didn't realize that.
Absolutely. There's Pendergasts and the Pruitts are part of that family. I used to practice law with the great-grandson of Tom Pendergast.
Oh, okay.
And so, sure, the family is about and around. Tom Pendergast himself had three children, two daughters and a son. His eldest daughter had children. And so, you know, the progeny of that marriage, and her marriage is depicted in the film on 16mm film.
Absolutely. And what a big social occasion that was in Kansas City. They were married right at 51st and Main, right?
That's right, at Visitation Church.
Visitation Church, yeah.
And it's fascinating footage because you see those beautiful Lincoln limousines come pulling up, and they've got the gangster whites, and the curtains in the windows, and there's just throngs of people outside of Visitation Church. And it's interesting because the camera pans up and down Main Street there, and you can kind of get, you know, a really good feel for what that looked like in 1929. And again, that film, to my knowledge, has never been publicly exhibited before.
Where did you find it?
You know, because of my work on Nellie Don and Black Hand Straw Man and the Union Station Massacre, people are much more willing to open up their personal archives. And
they know who you are now.
They do.
It helps.
It does help. And I call this film kind of the third in a trilogy of films because I have Nellie Don, Black Hand Straw Man, and now I have Tom and Harry, all of which really kind of are set primarily in the same period, if you will, from about 1900 up well into the 1940s. And that's a key thing about this film. When people go to see this film, they shouldn't expect to see the complete biography of Harry Truman. That is not what this film is about, because that story has been told again and again and again. If you look at what nationally has been produced and written about Harry Truman, usually they're not able to give a whole lot of detail about the machine itself. They mention political boss Tom, and they mention that he has control of the city, but they don't really go into detail. Well, what does that mean exactly, to have control of the city? How does he have control of the city? How did he get control of the city? And so this film very much, I hope, will stand as the definitive documentary film about the Pendergast machine for some time to come.
Again, our guest is writer, director, producer Terrence O'Malley. What do you hope this film achieves? I mean, and what is it about, Terrence, the 20s and the 30s and the 40s in this town that clearly fascinates you as much as it does?
Well, I tell people all the time that my films are produced and made for Kansas City audiences.
Yeah.
So that if somebody in Spokane, Washington, or Tallahassee, Tennessee doesn't like it or isn't interested in it, or L.A. or New York, I don't really care.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the people here in Kansas City want to know about the history of this town. And the thing about the 20s and 30s and 40s about Kansas City is that it was a unique city. First of all, Kansas City was the largest metropolis between here and Los Angeles.
And people forget that sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, how things have changed. But we were a huge deal back in those days.
Well, we were, because we were the last point major, you know, metropolitan community until you got to California. And so we were very much an industrial gateway and entryway back to the East Coast through the railroads and through aviation. And we had a very diverse economy. And so, you know, a lot of it thanks to people like the Pendergasts who, you know, brought commerce to Kansas City. But in terms of its scope, Kansas City, because of Tom Pendergast, was part of what you call the corridor of crime during the 1930s, those cities where, you know, gangsters would come and hang out. Generally, it included Hot Springs, Arkansas, Kansas City, Chicago, and then the Twin Cities, St. Paul and
Minneapolis.
Yeah. Right. And that was kind of the corridor of crime. So you had that kind of, you know, gangster element to it. The other thing is that the machine controlled city government. City government controlled the police. The police were purposely paid very poorly, so that they would turn a blind eye toward the petty offenses that were going on, a lot of which had to do with the speakeasies and the clubs and the bars that were open. So you've got this real wide-open, carefree nightlife. And, of course, that brings the musicians to Kansas City. They all flood to Kansas City because there's jobs to be had, because all you have to do is look at the advertising in the papers.
Yeah.
Even in the 20s, when it's illegal, they're advertising. And there's just club after club after club of live jazz going on at every
one
of these places.
You just can't believe it. I remember finding out for years when I first came to town, Terrence, I covered police downtown Kansas City, Missouri. I parked in a little parking lot right behind police headquarters at 12th and Cherry, which was right in the heart of this club after club after club environment you're just talking about. And all kinds of great players used to play in that abandoned lot where I used to park my car.
Right.
And you just can't believe how different it used to be.
Yeah. And, you know, you can kind of feel the ghosts of those, you know, magical people who, you know, produced all that great music. What happened?
Is there a documentary in that? Yes, there
absolutely,
is, Terrence.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. I, there's a lot more storytelling that can be done on that particular era. But one of the things that happened was they cleaned up 12th Street really in the early 1970s, and they knocked out
all that stuff.
Yeah, they did. And then when they put in the freeway also underneath the city, that knocked out a bunch of that knocked out the old red light district of Kansas City. We just basically eviscerated a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, the association between the two of these folks, Tom Pendergast and Harry Truman, you know, on one level never makes much sense. You know, Pendergast is Pendergast. Truman is this quintessential straight shooter. How did they come together and form this association?
It was essentially brother Mike Pendergast and his son, Jim Pendergast, the nephew, who served with Harry Truman in World War One, who were looking around for somebody to fill the judge seat for the eastern part of Jackson County. And Harry Truman was operating his private business of a haberdashery with Eddie Jacobson.
He was going out of business.
That was not faring well when one day the two Pendergasts, father and son, not Tom, but Mike Pendergast and his son Jim, go in and they tell Harry, we want you to run for this political position. And Harry was essentially elated, A, because he was having financial problems with the haberdashery. And secondly, it was located out in Independence, so it would be close to home. And so he leapt at the opportunity. They sponsored him. He won. He served for 2 years, and then he got elected out of office again 2 years later.
That was his only defeat in his now storied political career, right?
That's right. And it was a result of there was another guy that was elected in 1922, Henry McElroy, and he controlled the court, and he didn't allow – there were factions within the Democratic Party. He had goats and rabbits. He wouldn't hire any rabbits. The Pendergasts were goats, and so he not only didn't hire Republicans, he didn't hire rabbits. So 2 years later, what happened was the rabbits joined forces with the Republicans, who were very united with the KKK at that time, and they managed to elect out of office, defeat Harry Truman and McElroy. So Harry was kind of drifting for a couple of years.
But then he comes back and he wins the presiding commissioner's judge slot, which gave him – he was the top guy of the three judge panel,
right? That's exactly right. And so he had more control at that time. And then that's when his nexus and association with Tom Pendergast really congealed, because Tom Pendergast needed – Harry Truman to provide jobs on all those construction contracts.
There's an interesting moment in this film, several actually, but when 34 rolls around and Truman, he desperately needs a job. He's term limited out, I think, of the judgeship for Jackson County. A U.S. Senate seat opens up and Truman isn't even on the list of the top 10 possible candidates at that point, which of course surprised me, given at that point he had a number of years of association with Tom Pendergast. That surprised you too, that Harry wasn't even being considered initially for that job?
Well, certainly when you look back on it historically and see what Harry accomplished, it just seems not to make any sense that he wouldn't have been, at least on the top 10 list. But Pendergast's kind of perception of Harry Truman was as a bankrupt haberdasher. And so what happened was you had the chair of the Democratic Party, Jim Aylward, go with Jim Pendergast, the nephew, and they went to Tom and they said, look, because Tom wanted Aylward to run for that Senate seat, and Aylward didn't want it. He had a thriving law practice. And they said, look, what about Harry Truman? And supposedly Pendergast said, Harry Truman, he's just a damned failed haberdasher. You really think he could be a United States senator? And they said, well, look, we'll each put up $500 to start his campaign if you'll finance the rest of it. And Tom said, well, if you guys are willing to do that, I'll back him too. And boy, it was off to the races. And Harry ran a very well-oiled, very well-financed political campaign in 1934.
But then here comes 1940, and Harry Truman's up for re-election, Terrence, and his association with Tom Pendergast is being wrapped around his neck by his political opponents, and Truman can't escape it. And yet, he comes out with a narrow win in the Democratic primary, which was the key primary, I think, still in those days, against two opponents who, at least on paper, looked pretty tough. How did 1940 happen, and how did Harry Truman win that thing?
And that's where I begin the film, is to create the tension, is to let people know, because most people think he just, you know, oh, well, he got elected Senate, and then he got nominated to be vice president. Not at all. He is so lucky that he was able to hang on in 1940 because he was being opposed by the U.S. District Attorney who put Pendergast behind bars. And I might also mention that Tom Pendergast was serving time up in Leavenworth Penitentiary when Harry Truman filed for re-election for his own job. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, the other opponent was a gentleman named Lloyd Crowe Stark, who was the governor of Missouri, who was a turncoat on Pendergast. Truman had actually recommended Stark to Pendergast for his support in the 1936 election. Now 1940 comes around, and Stark is opposing Truman for that United States Senate seat. And both of those gentlemen, Milligan, the United States attorney, and Stark, are taking credit for having essentially toppled the Pendergast machine.
And Truman, because it's a three-way Democratic primary, the two other candidates split the vote, and Harry Truman barely squeaks by, right?
Well, and that's true. And what's fascinating is that 6 years earlier, Maurice Milligan's brother, Tuck Milligan, ran against Harry Truman along with another congressman in Missouri, and they split the anti-Pendergast vote in 1934. And so, you know, it's been written that every day Harry Truman, you know, was in office thereafter, he should have paid homage to the Milligan brothers because they essentially diverted votes away from, you know, Harry's main challenger and would give Harry just enough of a plurality to stay in office or win the office or stay in office.
What was Tom Pendergast's downfall? Remind us.
Tom Pendergast's downfall was monumental hubris, more importantly—
Monumental.
Yes. Yeah. He had a gambling addiction, and specifically, he loved betting on the ponies, and he was betting literally up to $2 million a year and losing lots and lots of money on a daily basis. He was known on the East Coast as one of the biggest suckers in the United States. He just couldn't help himself. So what happened was he needed more and more cash all the time. As a matter of fact, he used to have bags of cash delivered by mobsters here in Kansas City to his office at 1908 Main Street. But his need for cash made him pursue money, and then when he would get that money, what happened was he didn't declare it on his income taxes, so they got him on income tax evasion. Hmm. So if he hadn't been needing cash so much due to all of his gambling, then he might have been willing to declare that income. The other thing about it is when they indicted Pendergast, they had him, you know,
cold.
And he intelligently went ahead and pled
guilty.
Because he knew that if they cracked open that, you know, nut of some 30 companies that he had his fingers in, it would just become a mess. And Tom Pendergast would have been in much, much more trouble.
Terrence O'Malley's Tom and Henry, the Boss and the President, will be premiering, I guess, at the Screenland Armor and the Screenland Crown Center on Friday, October 19th.
Yes,
right?
And at the Rio and at the Faro out in Independence. So it's
that
opening
same
at,
weekend?
Yes, the October 19th, four theaters here in Kansas City.
So that's the big weekend. Again, the film is titled Tom and Harry, the Boss and the President. And Terrence, always good to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks,
you
Steve.
Bet. To find more information about our show at kcur.org, don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR, up to date. Tomorrow, the story of one man's wrongful conviction and the 18 years he spent in prison. Also, a look back at the 18-day running mate, McGovern Eagleton, and a campaign in crisis. Our show was produced today by Danny Alexander, Steven Steigman, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star. And you are up to date.